Okay.
All right, thanks again, and welcome to everyone. Welcome back. Welcome if you're new, but I think most people have been to these recently. I want to start with a bit of a recap. Not just a matter of going over everything we've just done recently, but because I want to explain that what we're doing is, in terms of looking at the first 11 chapters of Genesis and looking for things in it that are unusual and that we probably haven't really dug deep into before. That means what we're really doing is a textual study rather than a topical one. So we're looking at what the actual text of the Bible says rather than any topics or any theology that might go with it. So in looking at chapters 2 and 3 of Genesis last time, we weren't actually looking at what's called the fall or original sin. Those are all sort of theological terms in the way that we've come to regard them later. We're just interested in what the text actually says. And that's what we're doing again today and for the remaining two in this month, take us to the end of July. And then I'm having August off and eventually come back in again in September for some which will be more topical in the lead up to the next Foundations Conference. So we're continuing this approach for today and two more because there's lots more stuff in the opening chapters of Genesis. And what we really looked at last time, to bring the main points out of this again, was that suddenly in the middle of chapter two, we find that something is not good. Everything else that God has been making up to this point has been good, but suddenly there's something that is not good, and that is that the man was alone. And God decides he has to put that right. So he's going to make a helper. He's going to create a bit more. We're actually still in the middle of what we know from chapter one has been called day six. And in the end, day six is going to be good. In fact, it's going to be very good. But at the moment, in the midst of this, there's something not yet good. So we're expecting God at this point to get busy again and to do what he's going to do to create a partner for Adam. But he doesn't immediately. This day seems to stretch out and go on for a long, long time because before God gets around to creating Eve, Adam has to have a good look at all the animals and give them a name. And not just the animals, the beasts of the field, but also the birds of the air. So he's going to have a good look at them and give them a name. And the reason behind that is so that Adam himself can actually realize how different he is from the animals. He recognizes increasingly how alone he is because none of these other creatures are suitable partners or helpers for him. And he has to understand that deep down. So at the end of that process, in which he's understood the difference between what God has made before and who he is, then God can create a suitable helper for him. And he recognizes immediately that she is of the right kind, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, and so on. She is woman because she's taken out of man. An interesting challenge for those of us who want to share biblical truth with people is, do we actually really believe that this is a true account of the creation of woman? But I'll leave you to think that through, whether that's something you feel you can share with unbelievers who might look at you with a bit of a strange expression on their face. What, you really believe that's how woman came into being? Well, that's what the Bible says. So suddenly, instead of just having Adam, we've got Ish and Isha, man, woman, man and his wife, and so on. But this whole thing about the difference between humanity and animals is going to come into increasing sort of stark relief here, because the next chapter begins with one of these beasts of the field that Adam has just been looking at and naming and recognizing isn't of the right kind for him, is suddenly going to effectively go on the attack in chapter three and start to create havoc, really, problems, certainly, by talking to the partner that God has just made. It's almost as though, and we know that from later understanding and reading of the Bible, that there's more behind this than we initially get out of these stories. But just taking the text as it is, this beast of the field decides that he wants to try and disrupt or corrupt what God has made by attacking the person, the partner, the helper that he's just provided for Adam. It's almost as though he's either jealous or feels rejected or something is going on. We don't understand his motive behind this. As I say, later on in the Bible, we come to understand a bit more what's going on behind all this. But at this point, the creature is determined to produce a real disruption to what God has been trying to do. So we, as we went through chapter 3, we learn again that this serpent, which on the face of it seems quite human, he can walk, he can talk, he can eat, he can think, he can reason, is almost trying to still steal his place with Adam and deal with Eve at this point. As a result of this seduction, really, and the temptation that they fall prey to, in the end, mankind loses something of that initial humanity because the serpent has tried to reduce him back down to his own level, just simply by getting them to doubt how you hear the voice of God. And this is one of the ways in which mankind is superior to the animals. We can hear the voice of God in a way that other creatures can't. They have a sort of internal system by which they can hear or know what God wants, because they're made with instincts and so on. So they will react and behave according to their instincts, but humanity can do better than that. But only by hearing the voice of God and recognizing that voice and obeying that voice rather than the inner voice that might come along and say, well, that's all very well, God might have said that, but, and add our own sort of features to that. And that, of course, is effectively what happened by the end of the story, when humanity has lost something of that initial situation that Adam and Eve had with God, which made them feel very naked, very scared, and God had to begin a process of redemption for them. But basically, by engaging with one of these creatures, they started to lose a sense of what it was like to be human. And I say that because I think that this is part of the temptation that the world is under at the moment. You know, what does it mean to be human? Oh, it's just like being another animal. Well, that's what modern science tries to tell us, really, that we are more like an animal than we are like anything else. And we need to fight that battle, and we need to recognize that being human is far more than just being another one of the creatures that's roaming the earth. And I'm sure increasingly in the days to come, this distinction that God has set up between mankind and animals is going to be blurred even more, either through, using animal tissues and DNA and so on, creating hybrid creatures, and even creating transspecies and so on, denying the separation that God made in the beginning, and also the distinction between our divine humanity, our God-given humanity, and the way the other creatures go. So just watch out for that, because that temptation is still around for man and the creatures to try and merge more rather than keep to our own particular place. I just wanted to add this as well. Has any of you seen the film The Life of Pi? Anyone seen it? Some of you? About the young Indian boy on the boat with the tiger? Yeah?
Yeah.
I thought it was fascinating. There's a scene early in the film when the boy goes to see the tiger that they keep in their cage because they have a zoo. And he takes some meat for it, and he goes right up to the bars of the cage and he's holding out the meat, because he wants to connect with this tiger. And the tiger approaches, and the film obviously builds up the tension as they look into each other's eyes and so on. And just as the tiger's about to spring and not only grab the meat, but probably take his arm off as well, The father rushes in and rescues him just in time. And it's the dialogue at that point that I find very interesting, because the father has to say to his son, "What are you thinking? Who gave you permission to come here? You just ignored everything I ever taught you." And the boy's response is, "I just wanted to say hello to him." And the father goes on, "You think that tiger is your friend? He's an animal, not a playmate." And the boy responds, "But animals have souls. I've seen it in their eyes." And the father has to say again, "Animals do not think like we do. And people who forget that get themselves killed. The tiger is not your friend." So that was an interesting scene there, which I thought spoke into what we've been actually talking about. So that's just some of the ways in which we've been exploring the text so far in chapters 2 and 3. Feel free to make a comment at this point before we move on to something else, either because you've thought of something since last time or it's just struck you now. Does anyone want to make a comment at this point on anything on this?
Betty.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, it just occurred to me then, Paul, when you're talking, it reminded me of the lion will lie down with the lamb, but there's also the child will play with the cobra.
Yes.
Maybe it's going to return the animals, and I mean, we're obviously not the same, but we won't need to fear them.
But if you believe that prophecy to be literal and it's going to happen and so on, yes, this is one of the ways in which creation will be restored, is that there will be a difference in the way that we can look at animals again and relate to them. Perhaps originally humanity and animals were closer. I don't know, but they might have been. But certainly as the result of this this fall, if you like, the serpent became more creature-like because of what happened to him through the punishment, and perhaps therefore part of the way we have to treat animals now is a result of that. But certainly every time we engage with an animal, whether we're working with, say, a horse, or whether we are we've got a pet or something, should always be clear in our minds that we are not like the animals. We've got a couple more comments, I think.
Yes, we've got Chris, then Mary, and then George.
Oh, right, well, that's good.
You need to unmute, Chris.
Yeah. I had learned that Adam naming the animals was a sign of authority that God had given to him, and even before Eve was created. After that, he named Eve, so he was just going on with following up his authority to name the animals, and that's probably why Jesus said, I'm the head of the man, and the man is the head of the woman.
Okay, well, Adam named Eve after the fall, later, okay? Not the moment she was first created. They were just Ish and Isha at that point. But certainly, naming does, again, give a sense of authority, or at least distances you somewhat, okay? Yeah. It was a way of saying, you're a giraffe, okay? That means I'm a man, you're a giraffe, so there's a difference between them. And really what he was being shown was that none of these creatures were suitable as helpers for him.
Yeah, yeah.
So he should, however attractive that flamingo was, however wonderful the lion or the tiger looked, there's no way that they're a suitable helper for you.
Okay.
So let's move on to the next comment, shall we?
Mary, you need to unmute.
Yeah. I just was listening to a talk not that long ago about how animals were created on the same day as humans. And humans have a conscience, and we've been breathed into and have Holy Spirit, if we believe that. But there are some humans who have acted in such a gross way that they're almost reduced to the animals,
yes,
by the way they act.
I think that's absolutely right, that unregenerate man ones that actually go further and further into their sinfulness and so on, you can say they eventually become, well, worse than animals. Sometimes we say them, but it's an interesting one. So in some ways, we are not that different, but actually, we are very different at the same time because of this image that God has given us. And it's only by realizing that image, though, and living that way, that we stop falling into the way. Because what the snake was really saying is, okay, you can hear the word of God if you like, but also listen to another voice, that natural voice within you that says, actually, I rather like that and I want that. Mm-hmm. Because that's how animals operate, just instinct, so they go for it. And we are meant to be able to cope with our desires. But the less you know God, the more you're in rebellion against God, the more you fall prey to your desires than your God-given ability to communicate with him. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's keep going with other comments, because these all...
George had a question. Yes?
Yes, it's just really clarification. When we talk about the serpent and his punishment by crawling on the ground, are we talking about snakes? Well, or are we talking about something different? Are we talking about, for instance, were snakes not then created?
They weren't snake-like. They were... The serpent that's come here is more like a lizard or a reptile, because it obviously has legs. It loses its legs. I'm told that if you examine a snake carefully, there are vestigial legs, that as though they once had legs. But I don't know how accurate that is from a biological point of view. But it's as though somehow this creature became the snake that we now know.
So the snake then, if I... going back the way, is in fact the serpent.
Well, yes. But when you see in your picture books of a tree with a snake twining around and two naked people underneath being tempted by this thing hissing in their ears, it wasn't like that, because the serpent at that point was not snake-like. But this is...
And had the ability to talk as well.
Exactly. And that's part of the weirdness when we looked at this before. This was really weird, because suddenly there's a conversation going on, and we don't really know how that conversation happened. Don't ask me what language they used or how they communicated or whether this was normal, because there's no great surprise suddenly, oh, says Eve, an animal is talking to me. That's odd. Let me go and investigate further. They're just having a chat.
Has every snake the capabilities of a serpent? Well, or has that all been cut?
If you're asking me, does that mean originally that the animals, all the animals, had some ability to communicate?
No, it's just really the serpent.
Well, we don't know, but possibly.
Although potentially that would be all of them,
Yeah, well, that's part of... The other thing to get out of these stories, as I've said, is that we're trying to look at them as though, like Abraham, we've just come out of the Chaldees, Mesopotamia, where they had all their own stories of this same kind within the Mesopotamian culture. They had their creation stories, their flood stories, their various other stories like Babel and maybe Cain and Abel and so on, but all very different, all with different gods. The thing that, if you imagine you're Abraham hearing these stories and realizing this is now the God that you follow, these stories are incredibly compact. They don't tell you everything. This whole business of the fall of man is done in about 20 odd verses. It's extraordinarily brief, but in some ways it's enough. But being Hebrew storytelling, it has that wonderful feature that actually there's lots of gaps in there for you to ask questions and to think more widely around it. It doesn't try and tell you everything. So in that sense, it's both enjoyable, because you can read it again and ask different questions. Different things will come to mind like that because of all the oddities that are in it. But there's enough in it for you to engage like Abraham and the later Israelites would have done, to think, what kind of God am I now dealing with? What kind of God am I following? God is the central character of all these stories. Any more comments? Yeah. I want to move on to our next chapter fairly soon.
Yeah, we've got Miriam and then Chris.
Okay.
It was just It was just a recap on what did you say about the first verse of chapter 3? Indeed, has God said, you shall not eat from the tree of any garden? Because mine's got a question mark.
Okay.
And I don't know what, can't remember exactly what you were saying about that last week. About
okay, so it's question. A recap from last week, is it? Okay.
It's a question.
Yes, what I said was that your English translation has turned it into a question. And often you read it as, did God really say? And what it almost is in the Hebrew is more of an incomplete sentence where it's like, it's not questioning whether God said it, but it's saying, so what if God said this? Or even if God said this. So he's not denying that God said it. It's just trying to sow a seed of, well, maybe you could think about this a bit differently. Okay? God said, blah, 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 but so what? Why don't you have another look at that tree and see if you hear a different voice? See if your inner voice says something and you might prefer that to what you've heard. Okay? So it's a very subtle way of sowing a seed, a doubt in that. So it's not questioning whether God said it or not. He's actually saying, yeah, so what? What if God said this?
Yeah.
And that's the way that we are tempted very subtly to disbelieve what's in the Word of God and so on.
Mm.
People can believe it's the Word of God, but still go, well, so what? Or even so, I've got another voice in my ear telling me something else. Let's bring that into play and so on.
Okay, thanks.
So that's what you're asking there. Chris, again, perhaps?
I had heard that the word for dragon and serpent in Hebrew is the same word. So actually God had to tell the serpent or the dragon, you will lose your legs because of what you did. But
okay.
The word is still the same. So he had probably to explain why all of a sudden the dragon looked different.
Okay.
But I don't speak Hebrew. I have no idea. That's why I need Hebrew scholars to tell me that.
Well, okay, here it comes then. If this comes up right, this is going back to one in a minute. But the serpent is the Nakash. Okay, the Nakash. That's the word. It is actually a translation of serpent, or serpent is a translation of it. But like a lot of Hebrew words, it can actually mean something else, like a shining one. It can display some sort of characteristics.
Yeah.
I don't know about dragon. They're mythical creatures anyway, but they may well have been part of other legends that other stories, were about. Creation stories involved these creatures. There's some very weird other alternative versions of these stories in different cultures. Really strange.
Okay.
Yes, this is the Nakash. Tom. Right. Well, what I thought we'd move on to next is the next chapter, the Cain and Abel story, which is even more full of weirdness. So I'm going to give you 5 minutes to at least read up to verse 16. So chapter 4, verses 1 to 16. You can read to the end of the chapter if you've got time on this, and then we'll start to look through it with the Hebrew text. But I shall ask you in 5 minutes, when you've done your reading on this, what did you find really weird about it again? What questions come to mind? So have 5 minutes now of reading on that.
Are you going to stop screen sharing?
I can do.
Okay, thanks.
Is that helpful?
Yeah.
You can keep the recording on if you like, because 5 minutes isn't a huge amount of time, and we'll probably just keep everybody muted.
Yep.
But I can see people again. Okay. Right, I think you can hear me again now. Is that right? Can you hear me? Justine, can you know one?
Yes.
Here? Good. That's 5 minutes gone, which I think is enough to have a read of this, but of course we'll be reading through it again as we look at it. But before we actually look at the text in detail, any questions, comments, particularly, wow, that's odd, that's weird, what on earth's going on there sort of thing? So, Christine, can you let me know if anyone's got a comment?
Elaine.
Okay, Paul. So I find it a bit weird that with Cain being the firstborn, that, and also that actually he's the one that falls out of favour with God, because I might be completely wrong here, but normally I thought that the firstborn had importance in Hebrew, in Hebraic.
Okay.
Thinking.
Yeah, certainly he's going to. But what you're saying is, why did God not look favourably upon him?
Yes.
Okay, we'll look at that as we go through it. Yeah. Anything else? I just want a list of things to start with.
Miriam, need to unmute.
Yes, I wondered what the in verse 5, the Lord appointed a sign for Cain, which was going to make sure nobody touched him, or if they touched him, they would be.
This is verse 15, yes? 15? You said 5, but I think you mean 15.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was the mark of Cain.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll have a look at that. I won't be able to answer very much on it, but it will come up as we go through there.
There's a farmer, is it?
Yes. Anybody else?
Marion? Yes. Just one moment, Elaine. Marion's next.
Yeah, sure.
It's just that in verse, hang on, 14 and 15, it mentions anyone and no one able to touch them. But these were the first people. There's no record of anybody else yet being born.
No, but there soon will be. So this is for the future.
Right, okay.
Okay. Yeah. But actually, just to put that up here now, we don't know that there isn't anybody else yet, because there's been, these are now grown up, so why shouldn't they have had more children in the meantime? Okay, and when people ask about Cain and his wife, suddenly there's a female of marriageable age who must have been around at some point. And in fact, who knows whether or not they were already married at this point. This is part of, we just are never told enough, which enables us to ask these questions. But certainly the point about this mark was that it would enable him to live out a full life. And we'll think about that again later.
Okay, Elaine wanted to come back.
Yes, please. So the thing is that Cain is tending the ground, and so he offers fruit, which is fair enough, but how did he know, you know, not to? So that's obviously the obvious thing he's going to offer. He's going to offer fruit, vegetable, not an animal.
Yeah, that's fine. Does that bother you?
It does a bit.
Okay.
It
won't later.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris is next, and then Betty.
Yeah. I read here in the One Newman Bible, verse 9, and the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? And he said, I did not know. Why does it say, I did not know, and not, I do not know?
I don't know, because I've always seen it as, I don't know,
yeah,
or I know not.
Yeah, that makes more sense, because it's in the same time frame or in the same tense.
Yes, I know Hebrew tense can be a bit funny, but I can't answer your question because I don't know the answer to it, but I've still got here just I don't know. But what is much more interesting is not his answer, well it is his answer, but also the question that goes with it. So we're going to dig into that quite a bit in a few minutes.
Mary's next. Need to unmute Mary. And then Angela.
Okay, my understanding about between Cain and Abel was that Abel offered the first fruits, the firstborn, whereas it doesn't say that about Abel. He just gave any old fruit.
Okay.
Not the first fruit.
Okay, but you're not telling me something that you found weird. You found something normal there, I think. Okay, but fair enough. Right. We'll come back to that, don't worry.
Well, Angela? Oh, mine was really to do with that, because it's so blunt. It just says, oh, the Lord looked with favour on Abel, but Cain, he did not. So you think, well, why? You
know? Oh, exactly. Very good question. And nor do we know how he showed that favour or otherwise. So another one of those things where we don't have enough detail to satisfy on all.
It didn't seem fair, you know.
It doesn't seem fair. Absolutely right, yes. Okay. Who else have we got, Christine?
Lynn and then Maureen.
Thank you. When did they start offering to the Lord?
Okay. In other words, how did they know to do this?
Absolutely.
Presumably Adam and Eve had told them that, and presumably God had told them to do that. But in all these chapters, one of the things we're looking for is things that happen for the first time. This is certainly the first time that we read about it happening. But whether it was the first time it actually happened, I assume it probably was, because otherwise they would have known how to do it properly, shall we say.
Yeah. So
that's a very good question. Any more weirdness?
Maureen?
Well, I thought it was a bit strange when, in verse 10, when he said, "And what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries to me from the ground." I just thought that was...
Strange way of putting it,
yeah.
Okay. I might say something on that as we go through it, yes. A couple more questions, then we'll move on.
Could I just say something about the same thing, really, in terms of when Cain killed Abel, and that was, was that the first killing? Was that the first murder, the first killing of a person? So when the Lord said, "What have you done?" I mean, obviously he was angry, and I don't know, we picked up something and killed him. But would there have been an understanding of the consequences of his anger?
Well, yeah, I think you've hit a good point there. And yes, this is the first. This is one of the firsts, and that is always means that we've got to think of it slightly differently from the fact that we might think this is fairly common. Mm. So we'll look at that, certainly, yeah?
Yeah, we have Scottish pattern, then Betty.
And then maybe we'll move on, okay?
Sorry, it's just verse 4, Abel brought fat portions.
Okay.
It's very specific.
Yeah? Okay. One more comment?
Yes, Betty?
There was a lot I found weird, actually, but most of it's been mentioned. But Cain was so upset that he'd be out of God's presence.
Yeah. Okay. Right, let's start to go through the story. And starting back in verse 1, it really links back into the previous chapter in two ways. God has already said to Eve that he will greatly increase her pain in childbearing. With pain you'll give birth. I always thought that was a bit strange as a punishment, because at this point she hadn't actually given birth. There'd been no childbearing. So to say to her, it's going to be worse than it's been before, when it hasn't been before, how would she know that it was greatly increased if you haven't already had the pain of a childbirth before? But she's about to experience the pain of childbirth. And this is a first, okay? This is the first time a human being has been born. Cain is the first human to be born. And Eve is about to go through a process that she probably could not have imagined what it was going to be like. Now, I know she might have seen animals giving birth, but for her to suddenly find her body changing and 9 months later, another tiny human come out of her body, that would have been more amazing than we could probably imagine. Now, you ladies who have been through this, I'm sure you found your first experience of this equally amazing, but you knew what was going to happen because you'd seen it before. You were told about it. You knew what birth was like and you knew what you were going through. But for Eve, this is the first time that to see a tiny little man come out of her body must have been extraordinary. And that might account for something that she's about to say. She also might have had in mind that back in, well, in chapter 3, verse 15, or what God had said, that one day one of her offspring was going to deal with the problem that had arisen with the enmity between the snake and so on. So in one sense, she was anticipating something, and she was probably also anticipating a lot of pain. But for the first time this happened, this would have been quite an amazing experience for her to go through. And as she bore Cain, she came out with a rather unusual statement. I have acquired a man from the Lord. Okay. Notice she doesn't say, I've acquired a man with Adam's help. Adam's long in the distance on this. He had his role to play some months earlier, but she's been very much aware that what's been happening to her has been something that's come from God. But as she says this, and your footnote will probably help you here, it's therefore how she decides to name her child. Here it is, Cain. Cain is based upon the word acquired, which is here, kaniti, and based upon it, what I mean is it's got the same three Hebrew consonants, k-y-n, but this is in a different order, k-n-y. So this poor first child to come into the world is given a name which means gotten or acquired. And it's based upon a sort of anagram of this word that she comes out with once she sees her child. I don't know whether you think that's a very nice name to give your firstborn, gotten or acquired, and whether it probably scarred him for life, but that's the name he had to put up with. But it came out of this remarkable experience that she was going through. Anyone want to comment upon that before I look at the next verse?
Chris?
I had read that she was expecting after the fall that her next offspring or her first offspring would be the seed that would conquer Satan and evil in general. And after that, when she found out that he wasn't, or it was not to be in her lifetime that the Savior would come, she named Abel, I think it's vanity or something like that.
So that's in a minute. Yes, that's the next bit.
As a reaction to her stupidity.
Let me put a question back to you on this. When do you think she realized that he was not going to be this promised offspring?
Probably before Abel was born, or after Abel was born. I thought it was close together, so that she found out Cain was not the one, and so she named Abel.
Well, let's leave that for the moment. My question back is, how would she actually realize that? While he's a baby, was there anything to make her realize that wasn't the case? It's an interesting question. Or was it only later, after he'd done what he'd done, that she realized this can't be what God has promised? So we're coming back to one in that minute. I think I had another hand up or so.
Hands up. Mary was first, then Pat, and then John.
Yeah, I was just going to say that very same thing that Chris had said, that she was expecting Cain to be the one that was promised. And
I think that's a fair assumption, that she might have assumed that this would happen straight away. Certainly you would see this. No reason not to think that. Yeah, anybody else? Anything different?
It's just that it was Adam, it named the animals, and he gave Eve a name, but yet it's Eve that names Cain.
Yeah, and as I say, based upon the experience of saying, I have acquired a man from the Lord. It's a very strange thing to say, really. Perhaps, have you got a different translation for this, anybody? Instead of, I have acquired a man from the Lord.
Mine says, with the help of the Lord.
It does. And that's not... was an interesting way of translating it, but there's no, those words aren't here.
No.
It literally is, acquired a man, et Adonai. And it's trying to put a lot of emphasis on the et Adonai as being, what does it mean from the Lord or by the Lord? And even the idea with the help of, she's sort of recognizing that there's been a partnership here. Mm-hmm. But like in any partnership, one person might have dominated rather than the other. Is she actually saying, she's obviously dismissing Adam at this point, you know, thank you, Adam, that was all very nice 9 months ago, but you've had nothing to do with this from now on. And is she recognising God as the primary partner or creator in this? Or is she actually saying, I've done this, oh, and the Lord helped out a bit?
With my experience of childbirth, Paul, I think she probably cried out to the Lord at some stage.
Yes, okay.
So, but, you know, she may literally have thought, with the help of the Lord, he eased the pain, perhaps.
Yes. But in terms of who is responsible, shall we say, for producing this, this offspring, we can't quite tell whether she was humble in this or whether she was saying more, I've done this, oh, and the Lord did his bit as well.
Maybe because God created everything else, she hasn't connected what she and Adam got up to having babies.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So there's quite a lot going on in here. And there is a Jewish tradition, which actually I discount, that suggests that Cain and Abel were twins. And that's based upon this, and she again, which can also might be translated in yours as later. Because what he doesn't say, as it would say elsewhere, that she conceived and bore a son and called him Cain, and then it would say, and she conceived again and bore a son and called him Abel. And because it doesn't mention again about the conception, it's been thought, maybe, that, you know, she conceived once and bore two people at the same time. But I don't think there's any other indication to suggest that they were actually twins. So I do think there was a time between, and that just means and later on. Now, Abel is a very interesting character. Has anyone ever read a book on the life of Abel? Is there a good reason why you haven't read a book on the life of Abel and why there isn't one? I mean, what would you say?
Yeah.
What is there to say about Abel? Give me his life story.
He didn't live long enough.
Well, you don't know how old he was, but you're right. There's nothing there to say, is there? He was born, he was given a name, he looked after some sheep and he got killed. And one of the things you didn't pick up later in the story is that when he'd been killed, that's it. There's no mention of any burial, no mention of what happened to his body. There's no mention either at that point of Adam and Eve. You'd have thought that the parents would have been on the scene at this stage and done something or said something, but they're not even in the picture at this point. So just as Adam has very little to do, he doesn't feature in the story after the first bit. Once Eve has done her childbearing bit, they're not involved, even though one of their sons has just murdered another one. And that to me is a bit weird. So Abel comes and goes very quickly. Now, what Chris was hinting at is that his name, Abel, Abal, you can actually find elsewhere in the scriptures. That's assuming I can find it. Bear with me. How does Ecclesiastes open? I don't know whether I didn't show you the actual Hebrew in Genesis first. I'm afraid we'll go back to it in a minute. But there's his name. Abel is Havel. Havel Havalim, which in the old version of Ecclesiastes is vanity of vanities. But actually, that's not a very interesting way of translating it. Do you have any other translations for the opening of Ecclesiastes instead of vanity of vanities? Because this is the meaning of his name.
Meaningless,
yes, okay. That's not a very nice name to have either. keep going. Has anyone heard any other ways of describing this strange opening of Ecclesiastes that Kohelet actually says?
In the One New Man, there's a note at the bottom that says, vanities are literally vapour or breath.
Yes.
Symbols of worthless, vain things.
Well, it's a vapour, something that comes and goes very quickly. It's like a cold breath on a morning that you suddenly see and then it's gone. One lovely description of this word I've heard of is it's like a soap bubble. It looks nice for a while as it floats and suddenly pop, it's gone. But it's something that, that comes and goes. And that's what this guy's talking about in terms of life. It's,
yeah,
it's
Mary's.
It's fleeting, so on. Yeah, go on.
Well, I, on my, in my Bible, it says that Abel, the meaning is breath or nothing.
Yeah. And so she actually gave him the name, here it is again, Havel, which if I was to translate it, I'd just say, and she called him fleeting.
Right.
Meaningless,
that's
quite a common one.
So it's interesting that he had a name which really fits what his life was like.
now, Elaine has a
hand up. Interestingly, in the Message, verse 2 it says smoke, nothing but smoke.
Right.
And then there's other versions keep saying meaningless.
Yeah. Yeah.
Instead of vanity of vanities.
Yeah. Well, vanity is a strange sort of word that we don't use very much now in that sort of context of it. But yeah. But we got the idea behind his name, which seems to fit a life which just comes and goes. And in the end, everybody knows about Abel, but only because of Cain and Abel. Only because he got killed. Now, why was Cain a tiller of the ground and Abel a keeper of sheep? Or let me ask the first bit, why was Cain a tiller of the ground? Why was that what he did?
Doesn't say.
Well, what did his father do?
It was a chip off the old block.
Exactly. It was a case of the firstborn taking up the profession of the father. So Cain had the job of being a tiller of the ground, which actually was a way of describing what Adam was going to do. But part of his punishment was that he would have to work the ground from which he was taken once they were expelled from Eden. And it was going to be hard work. And he would go back into the ground. This word ground is going to be absolutely crucial to both the story we've just read and this one here. And of course, it's the word Adamah. So Adam's name keeps coming up with the context of the ground, the earth, and so on.
And
that will come up again in his punishment. Yeah?
I was trying to take it off. It won't come off. Sorry, I don't want to put my hand up.
<Don't worry. laughs> So Cain got the first job because he was the firstborn, and therefore Abel was the second one, and he looked after sheep. Literally the word ro'er means shepherd, that sort of thing. Now then we come to these strange offerings, and we've already discussed how did they know that was what the right thing to do was. Was it something that had been going on, or was it something that they suddenly thought of? Okay, and I think you've already sort of talked about this sufficiently, but I'll just emphasize it again, that both of them were meant to bring what they were involved in. So there's nothing wrong at all with Cain bringing the fruit of the ground, and there's nothing wrong with Abel bringing of the flock. So what was the difference, and what was it that made God favour one than the other? And that is, Abel brought the firstlings of his flock, and it says firstlings here, the first fruits, apparently. And the fat of it means the best of it, the choice portions, it probably says in other translations. In other words, Abel recognised that what he had to bring as an offering was the first, as in like the first fruits, and therefore also the best. And all Cable did is he just bought some of his fruit and veg. Now, you may say, okay, why is that fair? And why did God still have respect for one more than the other? But it's almost like both bought the right kind of things, but Cain, his attitude was, oh, well, I'll just bring some of what I've got and that will do. Abel had a different attitude because he brought the very best. And of course, the the essence of the sacrifices that we're going to read about in the rest of the, well, the whole Bible really, is that you bring of your first fruits and you bring of your best.
So his attitude.
It would be. It would be an attitude towards it, yes.
Can I mention something, Paul?
Yes, sorry, is that Stephen?
You may be referring to this in a moment anyway, but
Hebrews
chapter 11, verse 4, by faith Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain. So the attitude was actually reflecting his faith, that he knew he needed to bring to God something of the best, whereas Cain seemed to have lacked that.
Yes, thanks, Stephen. I hadn't actually thought to mention that, but you're quite right. Part of the Great Faith chapter. Yeah. And this is where we do have this later revelation and commentary in the New Testament upon this.
Yeah.
And to me, that's good because it's not off beam. It fits in very well with what we would get out of the story anyway.
Yeah.
So it was attitude stroke faith towards it. It's almost like Cain wasn't that bothered, really. So it's time to make an offering, or Abel's doing it, so I'll bring some stuff as well. And so out of that, we've got the situation then where, if I can keep this steady, I'd say how God showed that favour or not is not clear, but Cain didn't respond very well to what had just happened. And so God has to have a little chat with him, really. And he says, well, it takes rather a lot of time over this, and says, if you do well, you'll be accepted, if not. And then comes this rather strange bit about sin at the door, and to you shall be his desire, and yet you may rule over him. Now, the word desire has already featured twice in the earlier stories. Can you think where the word desire has previously occurred before this chapter?
To Eve, for Adam.
Yeah. Which seems to be part of her punishment, actually, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the end, towards the end of chapter 3.
It's also when Eve saw the fruit and she desired it.
She did. And that's based upon the fact that as she was going through this process, she saw that it was good food and then pleasant to the eye, and that developed into a desire, and that caused the problem. Now this word desire, teshuka, is quite an interesting word. I don't know how you think of the word desire, but some desires can be very good and some desires less so, and the way it's often described, which is quite interesting, is some desires are based upon our need for ourselves, and other desires are based upon the fact that we've got so much to give that we have to give it. And the sort of example that would be given would be just that, just as much as the calf desires to suckle, the mother desires to nurse. That's the way I think the rabbis express it. In other words, the calf has a real desire because it needs the milk to live. The mother doesn't have that same kind of need. She doesn't have to do it, but she will because she is full and wants to give out of her fullness. So you can have that kind of desire, which is a good desire. And that's used to explain what people often sort of ask as a sort of strange question, perhaps. How much does God need us? I mean, surely he doesn't need us at all. He's God. He doesn't need us, and yet somehow he seems to need us. But his need of us is different from our need for him, because without him, we're dead. We're done before. We've got no hope. Okay? So our need for him, our desire towards him, is a matter of life and death. God's desire for us is not that if we're not around, he's in a bad way, but that desire is based upon a fullness that needs to overflow. He's so full of love and grace and everything else like that, that his desire towards us is just to give and to go on giving. So that word desire is packed full of sort of two kinds of meaning, really. And I think, therefore, when it says about the woman's desire for her husband, it's not a sexual desire that's going on here. It's her desire to give and give and give to the man that she's given herself to. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's part of the way that she has been made and created to operate. She has a desire. Another way it's often put is the land desires the rain, because unless it rains, it can't grow anything, it dies. So the land has a desire for the rain. So surely the rain doesn't have a desire for the land, but it does, because if the water stays up in the clouds, then it never fulfills its purpose. The rain has to fall to the ground, otherwise it's not being rain, and it lacks something because of that. So the rain is prepared to fall and give itself to the ground, even though it doesn't gain anything as such, other than just the desire to give. And then the land receives it, and its desire then creates the life in the land, and so on. Anyway, I just thought I'd explain a bit more about this Hebrew word as it crops up here. But there's a real sort of talking to going on here between God and Cain, and whether it has any real effect, we'll have to wait and see. Perhaps it doesn't. But it's verse 8 and 9 which becomes a little more weird again. Now, let's dig into verse 8. Have a read of what you've got at the beginning of verse 8 and see how it compares with what I've got here. Anyone want to comment upon their verse 8?
I've got that he told his brother.
And does it then say what he told him?
No, it says, and it came about. But presumably it's referring to what's just happened.
Right, so would you like to read out what you've actually got in verse 8?
And Cain told Abel, his brother, and it came about when they were in the field that
Cain... Okay, so in other words, the opening of verse 8, you think links back to verses 7 and maybe 6 and so on, yes?
Sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. It's an interesting idea. Anyone else got anything from verse 8?
Yeah, it says, now Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field.
Okay, that's the standard NIV version. Mm. Anyone else want to comment upon that?
Ed? Okay, Pat?
It says, and Cain said to his brother, let us go out. And it's the let us go out, because it's a phrase that's repeated. Right.
Okay, have you got a footnote? If you've got the NIV, you'll have to the phrase, let's go out to the field. Does it tell you anything in the footnote? Well, isn't it strange that that phrase is not here and it wasn't in what someone else read out?
It's not in the Good News even.
No.
It's not in the Message.
Yeah. The whole bit, let's go out into the field, has been added by the translators.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason is as follows.
They were out in the field.
Okay. Now, if you look at what it says here, and Cain talked with Abel, his brother, that's fair enough. That's a contained sentence. If you change it to, and Cain said to Abel, his brother, you then need to say something about what was said. You need to add some speech. Okay, let me say this again. Everywhere else where you had, and the Lord said to someone, you have what was said. Okay? Now here, Vayomer Cain El Haval is, and Cain said, that is the word said. It's the same here. Okay? So the Hebrew says, and Cain said to Abel, his brother, and then it doesn't tell us what he said. Which is why the translations have either added something, or they've changed the word said to talked or told, because that doesn't require any speech to follow. let me make that clear again. So if it's, and John talked to Jane, fair enough, they had a chat. We don't need any more. If it says, and John said to Jane, you're waiting to find some words that they said, okay? You need the speech that followed. You need something. So actually, it's weird in that it starts off, and Cain said to Abel, and in one version I've got, very interesting, it reads, and Cain said to Abel, dot, 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 as in, I'm not telling you. Okay, it's missing. but they had some kind of conversation, and we don't know. Now, it's quite a reasonable assumption that if that becomes told, it means told in what's just happened. Because, again, we don't know in all this business of whether the offering was accepted or not, whether Cain knew what happened to Abel and Abel knew what happened to Cain. Did they bring their offerings at the same time and they both know what happened to each one? Or did they bring them separately and therefore Abel says later, okay, Cain, how did that go with you? How did your offering go down? And so on. Did they have a chat about it later? So it might be what they talked about, but the Let's Go Out Into the Field addition is based upon the idea that Cain is actually leading Abel on and wanting to get him out in the open where he can deal with him. So it's a very interesting addition, as though it's part of Cain's scheming to Abel, which may or may not be true, but it certainly isn't there in the text, okay? Is that clear on that? Anyone want to comment further on that? Okay, let's go on to the next bit then. How did Cain kill his brother? How did he do it?
It doesn't say.
It doesn't say. Go on, use your imagination then. What might have happened?
A stone, maybe.
Yeah. There's certainly no other weapons around at this point. I used to think, yeah, he got hold of a big stone and just smashed it against him. Any other ways it might have happened?
If the conversation went a different way and they did discuss what had happened and Cain said, well, what did the Lord say to you? And he may have just been overcome with jealousy and got so wild that he hammered his brother to death with his fists.
Well, he might just have struck him, yes, with his fists. Yeah. Or he might have, what else might he have done?
Arm implement.
Well, good point, yes. I don't know how he tilled the ground, but he probably had a spade handy to whack him over the head with.
Well, strangled him.
I think someone just said strangled, is that right?
Strangled, yeah.
Yeah, that's another option. Yeah, okay. Again, we're not told, which is interesting. No. We do have this phrase about your brother's blood, which might suggest that something happened to make him bleed, but that could just be a phrase to represent, you know, the fact that he's dead. Now, let's ask the next question on this then. Do you think he actually murdered him? Did he do it intentionally?
I would say yes.
Why? Why do you think that?
I think he was so jealous that his brother had given something to the Lord that was acceptable and his wasn't.
Yeah, so you think it was then an intentional scheming plan rather than, as someone had just said, he struck out in anger?
Well, it might be because...
Mary, you're muted.
Sorry, Mary, you need to unmute again.
If they were just chatting together, Cain talked with Abel, then that's maybe the point where he became angry and lashed out.
But in fact, nobody died at this point, so he doesn't even know what death is.
Say it again, please.
Elaine?
No.
Hang on. Someone just said something and I didn't pick it up. Who was it?
I think it was someone in the room with Elaine.
Yes.
Right, my fault. Go on then.
Nobody had died before.
Yeah.
So the thing is, they didn't know what death was. And also, he actually struck out in anger. It wasn't intentional.
Okay. I'm coming to the first point you made in a minute. Now, it depends whether you're connecting this talk with the action, because it just says, and it came to pass. It doesn't necessarily mean straight away. It says in my version, and while they were in the field, but that's because and they were in the field, but that's because it's just said, let's go out into the field, which is this additional talk, which suggests that Cain has got a plot going on here. But if he was just suddenly angry and jealous, then in fact, it's not murder, it's manslaughter. Now, if anyone going to be able to solve that little riddle, any Miss Marples around, any Poirot's to tell us whether it really was murder or manslaughter? Well, anyone found any other clues?
God cursed him. So it surely he wouldn't curse him. It was by accident.
Okay.
John
so
Brindley.
What you're trying to say there is that you're looking back at the punishment and therefore the punishment fits the crime. Okay. I'll come back to the punishment later.
I was wondering whether, because God had said that it was sin was crouching at the door and he'd have to overcome it.
Right. And
that this is the desire to kill or to fight in his anger, and he isn't overcoming it.
Unless, of course, the sin stroke desire was jealousy and anger rather than full murder. Okay. Anyone else got any thoughts on this?
Less than manslaughter.
Okay.
I think actually that it sounds to me as though it could have been premeditated.
Right.
So I think he may have possibly had this planned when he went out into the field.
Okay.
With his brother.
Well, I've got two more people want to say something before I reveal all.
Mary?
Well, it definitely says killed. And, you know, in the Ten Commandments, which is obviously much later, it said, thou shalt not murder.
Okay, so what you're trying to say...
It's killed.
So what you're trying to say is this Hebrew word, which is here translated like this, the one that would eventually be used for murder...
Oh, really?
Okay, I don't know. My clue, my big reveal is somewhere in one of the letters, and it might be John or one of the others, it says Cain the murderer. Mm-hmm. So the New Testament commentary on it calls him a murderer. Okay?
Okay, I have a couple of hands. There's Chris and then Pat.
Okay.
I'm sure that they knew what death was all about, because God said to Adam and Eve, if you eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, you will surely die.
Okay.
What way? But they knew that there was a consequence to it. And for me, it doesn't make any difference if he just killed him, manslaughter, or if he murdered him, like premeditated. He killed him for no apparent reason, or no reason that God would sort of take into account. And so he was contrary to what God had said.
Okay,
right. And he knew what the consequences would be, and he played dumb and said, I had no idea that this would happen to me. Now you have to give me a mark so nobody kills me.
Well, okay, we'll come to that in a minute. Was another comment on this little bit?
I think they did know about killing, because Abel brought the lamb, it was killed. And secondly, later on, he's given a mark as a mark of protection.
Oh, well, okay, yeah, right. So let's get this together then. Later on in the New Testament, it says Cain the murderer. So that to me means, yes, it was murder, not manslaughter. Okay, so we'll leave it at that. Now, the interesting point you mentioned now about death, they knew about death in the sense that they might well have seen animals die. You've already mentioned that the offering that he brought, would, if it was a sacrifice, it would probably have been a dead animal. And God had already killed animals to make their garments with skin and so on. So they'd seen death before. What they'd not seen before is a human die. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether at this point, when Cain strikes him, strangles him, or whatever, he actually realizes that he is going to create a corpse. He might just have thought he was going to hurt or injure or do something, but suddenly he's looking down on the floor and he's seeing something for the first time. Just as Eve, for the first time, saw a tiny newborn baby come out of her body, now Cain is looking down and seeing a lifeless human body, and that was the first time that he'd seen that. And then God comes along and asks this question, where is Abel, your brother? Why do you think he asks him that question? And if you were here last week, think back.
Mary, you need to unmute.
Wasn't it the firstborn's job to look after his brothers?
Oh, it might have been, yes, that might have explained
it. And so by saying, am I my brother's keeper, he actually was supposed to be his brother's keeper.
Oh, absolutely, yes, that explains this bit, that's fine. I'm still looking at this very first question. Where is Abel?
Betty and then Pat Reynolds.
Well, that was what the Lord said to Adam and Eve, wasn't it, in the garden, after they'd sinned.
There are lots of parallels, and this is one of them. Now, do you remember what we said about that question before? Adam, where are you?
No, I can't remember.
Well, why aren't you here?
Yes, it's not the usual word for where.
Yeah, that's right.
And where's your location? Let's play hide and seek. Where have you gone? Where are you? This is, where have you gone? Or why isn't he here? So the Lord turns up and is basically challenging Cain as to, well, I mean, the body's there lying on the floor, presumably, or it's around. He's actually asking a very deep question here. Where is Abel gone? And when Cain answers it, I don't know. I think he's genuinely puzzled, bewildered, because he's looking at this dead body that used to, only recently, be able to walk and talk and so on. And now he doesn't know where his brother Abel has actually gone. He's still seeing the body, but where is Abel? I don't know. Where's he gone? So he may have seen dead animals before, but this was the first time that a human had actually gone somewhere, even though his body was left behind. And it's the experience of not just knowing about death, but actually seeing it happen that was affecting him at this point. And then comes the rest of it, what have you done, and so on, as God drives the point home, if you like, about this. Okay?
Chris has a comment.
I thought that God wanted to find out from Cain what his motivation was, if he understood his own motivation. And what you just said, in the next verse comes, what have you done, as in, do you really know what you just did? Okay, he's lifeless. Yeah.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? Why did you do it? What made you do it? Or was the serpent around as well to influence him, as the serpent had influenced Eve? And so these are the thoughts that go through my mind. God knew his motivation, but he wanted to hear from what he was.
I think that's a good point behind the what have you done. As always, God knows the answer beforehand, but he wants Cain to own up to something here, yes. I don't think the serpent is necessarily around anymore. I think he's done his worst, and it's now left to us to live out, if you like, the awfulness of what happened in the previous chapter. So so now comes the bit that follows on from that, and again, notice that there's a lot of references to the Adamar still, okay, the ground. You're meant to be tilling the ground and so on. Your brother's blood cries to me from the ground. And now there is going to be a punishment which is related to the very ground that Cain was so used to. And this is why I think when he eventually says, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Now, why do you think he... Well, let me first of all say about the punishment, that eventually the punishment for murder was going to be death. God doesn't apply the death penalty at this point. So there are mitigating circumstances here, which is why I posed the question, was it only manslaughter? If if the death penalty was for murder, what was the punishment for manslaughter eventually going to be? Do you remember? If you accidentally killed someone, what could you do?
Didn't you go into a special place to be protected?
Yeah. Remember what they were called?
Refuge.
Citizens of refuge, yes. You had to flee. You had to, if you stayed around, you would be attacked by the family of the one you just killed and so on. They wouldn't know whether you'd done it accidentally or not, so you're in danger. But the punishment, effectively, for manslaughter was exile, that you had to go and set up home somewhere else. Okay. Now, that actually is the punishment that is dished out to Cain. He is going to be driven out. So God, even though I'm saying he was a murderer, God is at this point giving him the punishment that was eventually going to be due to manslaughter. But why is it more than he can bear?
Bird and then Elaine.
Because he's no longer going to be working with the ground.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Everything he's known and he's presumably enjoyed and so on, is like Adam was told things were going to be worse for him, but Cain's punishment is worse. Adam was going to still be able to till the ground. He would find it hard work and he would still get something out of it. But Cain isn't even going to be able to do that. Mm. Adam was banished from Eden, but he managed to find another place to live. Cain is not going to find anywhere to live. He is going to be a fugitive and a wanderer in the earth, in the Aretz. Okay? Mm. So he actually gets a worse punishment from that point of view than Adam seems to do. And it is related to the one thing that he really knew and loved. He's going to be rootless and fruitless from now on. And then he's got this extra fear that he's going to be killed in return. Okay? But God's dished out this punishment. When you till the ground, it won't give you anything. And a fugitive and a wanderer, you'll be in the earth. Okay? And he's just devastated by that. It's far more than he can actually cope with. So how does God deal with this? Go on.
It says in a footnote in the Amplified Version, it means too great to be forgiven.
Ah, okay. That's this bit, is it? Gadol avoni minto.
Yes.
Gadol is great or big. I can't work out which bit's the rest of it. Okay. But what is interesting is this other word here, gerashta, or gerasht, about being driven out. This is the same word for divorce. In other words, it would be like a complete split, change. That's the end. He's being divorced from the face of the earth. And also from your face shall I be hidden. Which actually wasn't the case even with Adam and Eve. God did not turn his face away from them, actually. But Cain is being dished out a much stronger punishment. So what about this extra fear that he has about being killed? So this comes back to this strange bit that you mentioned before, the mark of Cain. Has anyone got any idea what that is? No?
Really?
Not really, but in ancient Chinese, it's a cross, I think, for vengeance.
And that's okay.
On the elder brother.
Well, so, but don't know what you mean by in Chinese. Chinese?
The ancient Chinese on the bones, you know, that very ancient Chinese language that sometimes seems to show things like eight people in a boat for a vessel. Also shows for the elder brother that's being vengeful. Shows a cross on the top.
Okay.
Of the man. Yeah.
Okay. What's interesting is that the word here for mark is actually ought, which is just sign. And people do think that it could be a sign like a cross, actually. Yeah. The other option, and by the way, the question, does anyone have any idea? I think the point is, no, we don't. We don't have any idea. So don't worry if you think I didn't know. But Jewish tradition has come up with a rather strange one, that it meant that Cain grew a horn on his forehead. Quite why they think that's a useful understanding of this, I don't know. And then some people think that led to the fables about unicorns. That's where we got the idea of a unicorn from, because there was no real animal, a unicorn. But Cain went around from this point onwards with some kind of horn going on his head. Now, it looks, this other strange bit, therefore whoever slays Cain, again, apparently the Hebrew is a bit weird. I don't fully understand this bit, but it's as though these two bits of the sentence don't really connect. As though God says, therefore whoever slays Cain, ... vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold, and that means that the him is actually to do with Cain, not the person who slays Cain. But I can't demonstrate that too much. But God was delaying the death penalty upon him. We don't know how Cain died. We know that he went out from the presence of the Lord, and in the same way that Adam was banished eastward, Cain went eastward. He lives in the land of Nod, and I think your footnote might tell you what Nod means. Does anyone know?
Isn't it wandering? Wandering.
Yeah, it means wandering. Mm. So he lived where everybody just wandered around. That's part of his punishment. If you look ahead to the bit where it seems to say he built a city, which might seem to contradict that, has anyone got any other thoughts on the phrase he built a city? Anyone got a translation that's a bit different from that?
Elaine?
Is it because cities are often in the Bible villages?
Well, it would be small, yes, but is the word built? Does it actually say that in yours?
Yes.
Nobody got a different tense for the verb.
And he was building a city.
I've got building.
Yeah. Was building, which means he spent the rest of his life trying to build it and he never finished. In Hebrew, there's a completed action, an incomplete action. Mm. And this was, it's like a game, if he tries to till the ground, he will get nothing from it. He tries, from now on, nothing is going to work for him. He wanted to build a city, he had a go, he spent his life building it, and he never settled in it. Even though he gave it a name after his son. But even that, he wasn't fruitful, he wasn't prosperous, and so on. He did, of course, have children, and so on. And the reason that people think that the rest of the chapter gives us details about his family. This keeps jumping every time I go up a page, but you'll be able to read it yourself better than that. But we now get to Cain's family line come in. And then it's the next chapter. We meet Seth, which is for another time, but we get back to something more pleasant. Is that towards the end of this chapter, you get this strange guy called Lamech, and his children and his wives, and the name of one of his children is Tubal-Cain. You get the same name coming in again. But Lamech is this guy that says, I have slain a man for wounding me and a young man for hurting me. That's just poetic parallel for it. So Lamech has actually killed someone, and he starts to mention if Cain should be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 17 sevenfold. There is a thought, again, not provable really, that maybe eventually Cain was slain by one of his descendants, Lamech, and that's how he met his end. And Lamech called one of his sons Tubal-Cain, part of it. So maybe he did get murdered himself as a result, But that's just a bit of extra tradition and speculation based upon what we read in all this lot here. But of course, the line of Abel, of course, never had children, so that didn't get very far. And Cain's line was going to be eventually wiped out in the flood. So there had to be another line start, and that's why the next chapter deals with Seth, Set, as he's known. There he is. Interesting, we call him Seth, but the Hebrew actually is the other way around. It's not Seth, it's Sheet. It's there in the Hebrew if you want. But there's a new line going to be set up, and from this line will come Noah, and the redemption continues from that point of view. So we've been looking at all the bad bits, really, in this, and there's still some more bad bits to come. But as always, God is sort of working out his purposes, but it's going to take another son, because Abel was slain and Cain got his comeuppance eventually through that. Okay, I've had my time. Any more comments, though, or interesting thoughts on this chapter, this story in particular we looked at?
Jeremy?
The additional genealogy is interesting, isn't it? And I wondered if it could be partly that Lamech might have been in a generation where the Lord actually killed the one that claimed 70 times 7 or whatever, rather than defending him. I don't know. But also, it seems strange having the woman's name there.
Yeah.
And I wondered if it might possibly be that is part of our genealogy. And that's why it's mentioned, that she is someone that's related to to the person on the ark.
Well, yes. Which particular woman are you talking about here?
Naomi or Nehemiah.
Yes. Traditionally, they believe that she was Mrs. Noah. She became Noah's wife.
I didn't know that. I was just thinking that in my own head.
Yeah, that is simply Jewish tradition. But based upon the fact of, as I said before, why does a woman get named if she's not going to be significant to the story? Mm. Now, there's only four women named before the flood: Eve, Lamech's two wives, and all we know about them is the children that they gave birth to. So that's not that, well, it is significant, but it's not a big part to play. So it is rather strange that suddenly three women are actually mentioned. But I suppose that if Lamech actually said what he said in verse 23, you've got to know their names. Otherwise, what he said doesn't make a lot of sense. He boasts to his wives. There's a thought here: is this the first person that actually married two women?
Yes, that was going to be my question.
Yeah, it would seem so. And maybe, therefore, this later on it was going to be okay, but at this point it was not okay. Now, Lamech comes across as not a very nice character, okay? So he marries two women. That probably shows what his attitude is like. He has these various sons. And the other thing you learn about what's happening at this time is that there's a big development going on in terms of musical instruments, metal tools, and so on. Mm. There's a big development going on at this point. And at that point, that bit of the story comes to an end, and we're going to pick it up with Seth from verse... I mean, the chapter numbers are all wrong again. The next bit of the story begins at verse 25 of chapter 4, from that point of view. We learn about the next line coming along before we read about it in the next chapter, if you like. Well, one thing which I'll leave for you as an interesting study is that if you want to do your family tree from Cain down to Lamech and then compare it with the genealogy in chapter 5 of Seth's line all the way down to Noah, well, who was the father of Noah? Can you find it quickly if you don't know? Who was the father of Noah?
Lamech.
Lamech. Not the same Lamech.
That's a different one.
It is. But if you list these two genealogies, the Cain line and the Seth line, you'll find a lot of similarities in the names, okay, which is interesting. But Cain's line is about to die out in the flood, because the only people that survive it is Noah's family, who came from that Lamech and back up through towards Seth. So you can enjoy yourself with some genealogies if you feel so inclined. Anybody else with any final comments or questions? I see there's a chat come through.
I just wanted, could I ask you, Paul, I mean, you just made an aside then when you talked about Lamech having two wives and it wasn't okay then, but it became okay.
Yeah.
Why did it ever become okay?
It became okay because young men were killed either in warfare, and so there'll be a lot of women without husbands or potential husbands. And it was never a good idea to leave a woman without the provider and protector of a man. So it became more acceptable because men were killed in war a lot. And it also became acceptable because then the stock of young men can be built up again, because you've only got one wife, you can't produce as many children as if you've got two or three. You have to hang around a little while and make another go. Now, at the same time, someone like Abraham or someone who became rich and powerful almost felt that they were entitled to a wife. Mm. So, if you like, it became a bit abused as well, although God doesn't seem to mind Abraham having, and I don't mean Hagar, I mean later on, Ketula, another wife, and so on. So it did become, if you like, a bit of a not good thing. Mm. But the reason why it was more acceptable later on is because men went out to war and got killed.
But then there'd be several wives without the one husband.
Yes, but they may not have married yet. The stock of marriageable men would be declined. The balance, 50-50 balance, would go, okay? So there wouldn't be as many young men waiting to be able to marry. So the women were, to make it sort of balance up again, that's what could have happened.
But they were usually then, obviously, sometimes sort of passed on to brothers, weren't they? It was the family, the heritage thing, yeah. Well,
that was a different matter, but it was the same idea, therefore, and therefore someone could inherit a second wife, doesn't sound right, does it? But you know what I mean.
Bad news.
So are you saying that to have multiple wives is just a temporary thing?
Yes.
A temporary measure?
That's the way I tend to think of it. And I think by the time of Jesus, that had all, well, it would have been frowned upon from that point onwards. So it was allowed for a time, shall we say. Mm. Mm. I don't know much about it, but I read it once, you know, polygamy, right or wrong, so to speak. And it does explain it to some extent, but there might be a lot more to it than I've ever come across.
Another. Can I just ask who would have okayed it?
Within the human,
in society.
Well, yes, yes. If you, take for instance, you are the Israelites, you're conquering the land and so on, but you take casualties all the time, then it would have been the elders, the tribal leaders, or whatever, I suppose. Yeah. But don't push me too far on this. I'm getting out of my area of expertise on this. It makes sense that they did that for the reasons I mentioned. That's all I'm saying. And I'm not saying whether it was right or wrong or put any moral stance on it at all. Anyway.
No, it just seems to have started off a whole load of things, because also the women almost became spoils of war and things like that, doesn't it? So we could go on talking about this for a long time.
Yes, indeed. And one of the things we haven't dwelt on is with the creation of woman and as the helper, we might have mentioned this last time a little bit, the helper by his side, the one who was to live in close tension with him, and so on. That was obviously God's original intention. They seem to manage with that idea for quite a long time, which is fine. Okay, one or two people have had to leave already. The rest of you, unless there's any final comments, we'll find something else to do from these chapters next time. There's a lot. If you're looking for oddities, we've still got the Nephilim to think about. That could take a long time, but it won't take a long time. But there's the Nephilim coming up, who they were. And there's another, if you remember last time we talked about nakedness a lot, there's another strange bit of nakedness coming up later on. And the whole flood story has got some very curious bits and pieces to do with it. So we've got enough to last us for two more weeks. And that's without going back into Genesis 1 and looking at that, which we might do as well. But perhaps you don't find that quite so odd. I don't know. Okay. Bye for now. If you're leaving, should we stop the recording?
Thank you very much.